Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Hump with Katie. I'm your host, Katie Thoreau, and I have such an exciting episode for you today with a former teacher of mine, the great bassist, John Lockwood. If you're new to The Hump, this is a series where I interview some of the world's greatest artists and musicians and kind of find out why are they so amazing and how did it happen, what was their journey, and what can we learn from them. We've already had some fantastic guests like Christian McBride, Larry Grenadier, Rufus Reed, Justin Coughlin, and so much more. You can find all those episodes on iTunes, Spotify, and you can actually see them on YouTube. So go like, subscribe, write a comment, write a review. Hey, let me know who you want to hear from next. I'd love to thank our sponsors. And first up, we've got Jams World. I'm wearing my Jams World right now, of course. I'm embarrassed to tell you how many I have, but Jams World is an awesome clothing company in Honolulu, Hawaii, and they're giving our listeners a 15% online discount. And I love the clothing because it really keeps me cool and comfortable because the fabric's made from 100% spun crushed rayon and it's real art screen printed right onto the fabric. It's really cool. If you go to jamsworld.com and use the promo code JAZZ15, you'll get 15% off your entire online purchase. That's jamsworld.com. The next sponsor I'd like to thank is Kohlsteins. You guys, I absolutely love Kohlsteins String Shop. It's amazing. They have two awesome locations in Long Island and a fantastic online website, and they're offering our listeners a 10% online discount. Go to Kohlstein.com and use the promo code KD10, and you'll get 10% off your entire online purchase, or give them a call and they'll give you the discount as well. That's Kohlstein.com. All right, I am so excited to bring you today's episode. He is a former teacher of mine, an amazing bass player, fantastic educator. His name is John Lockwood. I always love talking to people who were teachers of mine or mentors of mine, because there's so many things that I never asked when I studied with them or I didn't think to ask. So today I got to really ask all of those questions. John has such an incredible and unique story. He grew up in South Africa during apartheid and was going to be a construction worker, but thank goodness he found music and the bass. He's played with everyone from Joe Henderson, Freddie Hubbard, Pharoah Sanders, Mel Lewis. It's a huge list and he has so much to talk, share, and stories to learn from. So without further ado, here is John Lockwood.
You can enjoy it. Hey, thanks so much for taking the time. I know like everyone's on the computer right now, so thanks for doing one more thing.
Yeah, I just did I've got a strangest ensemble. Actually, it's turning to be kind of fun, but it's a four-singer ensemble online. It's through New England Conservatory. I took it and I said, then I thought, what am I going to do? Because I can't sing. And it's actually working out kind of, you know, it's difficult at first.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fun when you don't know what to do and then they tell you what to do. They tell you what you need.
Yeah, I totally. They're pretty outspoken. Yeah.
Well, cool. So this is, I just start. This is my show, The Hump. And of course, The Hump is referring to the beat of the music or other things. You know, people take it somewhere else, but or the bass, you know. And but it's so great to have you because I loved studying with you. I think you're my favorite teacher I've ever had. And you really taught me how to teach myself. And then I love teaching now. So you're in the back of my mind when I'm teaching. So kind of want to just see what your story is, John. I mean, I know a little bit in pieces here and there. And then I remember a couple of years ago, I was like, long after I'd started with you, I was like, I had no idea you played with Mel Lewis and things like that. So I'd like to start from the beginning. I mean, you mentioned you're from Cape Town.
It was very primitive because apartheid was in full swing, so it was a drag. Everything was banned. Even the Beatles were banned. I mean, it was like, you know, we didn't have TV because of the politics. We had three radio stations. The English and Afrikaans station weren't worth listening to. There was no real music. There was the African station was the hippest thing to listen to at certain times. They had a lot of choral music though too. So it was limited. You know, it was pretty limited. So I didn't even know. I mean, there was no exposure to jazz except for my sister got into that movie, The Five Pennies.
No.
Louis Armstrong was in, and about Red Nichols, I guess, the trumpet player. So there was glimmers of hearing stuff, but it wasn't like, you know. And then I went to go to the store one day to get the latest pop record. And the guy said to me, the store was the size of the toilet upstairs. He said, I'm getting rid of records because I'm inventory. So you can have 50 cents. It was Ray Charles, It's the Road.
Mm.
I took it and kind of listened to it, got some glimmers of stuff. But I'd studied some classical piano, and then I did the rock guitar thing. And then I can't remember what I did. Yeah, then I had to go to the Navy. So everything stopped.
Oh, so you hadn't even studied music like formally?
No, not at all.
Teen.
I was already 18 in the Navy, so I did the Navy time for a year.
And that's mandatory, the Navy. Yeah,
no choice. You went whether you didn't matter what was wrong with you, you went.
Yeah.
And I ended up just cleaning the sides of what minesweepers pretty much, but that was it. Then I just, you know, I don't know. I came out of the Navy and I didn't know what the hell to do. So I went to construction. I was throwing concrete and, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. It was,
yeah.
Work, hard work, but actually it was kind of fun in some ways.
Yeah.
And something made me buy a bass. I mean, I don't know what
really?
It was. Yeah, it's just like, you know, I had a girlfriend way back that was during the beatnik time, you know, and he had
and
a
bass. And she was like, wouldn't that be lovely?
No, they had a border and there was a bass in his room and I snuck in the room one night. Mm-hmm. And I kind of, I don't know, but I bought a bass. And you know, my mother was always kind of worried about me because I had no direction. You know, just working mm-hmm. and hanging out on the weekend. And there was a guy named Merton Barrow who was always trying to open up. His big dream was to have a jazz school. And he, you know, he'd teach the kids from township, so the secret police would shut him down because they thought he was up to subversive activities, as they put it. And eventually, he did get the school going long after I left. But you know, he's still in his 80s now, but he's still going. He's still teaching. Mm. And he got me going. He turned me onto a saxophone player who played a little bass, this French guy. So that was the start. And then the guy, at that time, the Ray Brown book had just come out. I didn't know who Ray Brown was. So we ordered the book. It took about 3 months to come because everything was by sea. And I saw the book. I said, well, he must be a good bass player. You know, Ray Brown.
Yeah.
And so I went to the store, couldn't find it, and I found Nitrate. And then that was it. So that's where we got a little bit more serious. But I was already 19.
Wow. So, when you started to get serious, was it like, were you like practicing all the time or just trying to figure things out or constantly playing? Or were you just asking questions?
Well, there was no one to really, it's hard to explain how limited everything was. I knew, there was no scene that I knew of. And so, you know, I just kind of, there was this guy, Merton, who kind of, he led me into things. And I was still in construction. So, and then what happened was from the piano, I could take the reading, the bass notes of I knew intellectually the notes of a chromatic scale.
Okay.
Of the bass. I mean, the rest was just kind of, fuzzy.
Yeah.
So, but when you can play a chromatic scale on bass, especially in those days, you can gig.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
So I started, I started getting called for gigs. I didn't know if he said to me C7 or such, but that was like a foreign language. I didn't know what it was, And so, I started gigging, playing by a guy screaming at me, that kind of stuff.
What kind of music was it?
It was kind of jazz-based, but then I started getting more, as things started getting progressing. And then finally, the saxophone teacher said to me, look, I'm not a bass player. You should go to someone in the symphony. So when this old guy whose bass I still use, and he was an old English guy, and he was tough. I mean, he beat me up a lot, but I loved it because it was passion.
Yeah.
So cool. And then it's just one thing led to another. Then I started getting cool because I got the electric bass, so I could call for jingles. And then it was this learning, but more learning on the gigs than there was no formal school as such.
Kind of like saying yes and then figuring it out on the bandstand.
And getting, going, it was a bumpy road. It still is.
Yeah.
That's, I think it's sometimes maybe the best way to learn because it was just you screw up and then you've got to figure out how to correct it for the future.
Yeah. It's like either someone yells at you or they look at you or they don't say anything, which is almost worse.
Then your brain goes crazy.
Yeah, exactly. So I'd rather have someone yell at me and tell me what they want or what I did wrong, or I know instantly. But yeah, that's a great way to learn. And I hope that people still get that experience to do that.
That's the sad thing. It's kind of disappearing.
People are soft.
You can't. It's true. I mean, even in the schools, you can only do so much because otherwise, there could be repercussions.
Yeah.
I remember the old guy, he wanted me to play Othello. Mm-hmm. This is funny. So this is the bottom of the town hall where they used to play the symphony. And I wasn't getting the passion, you know. And he grabbed me and he was shaking me.
Yeah.
Is it you? You gotta get it out, get it out. And I was like, but I didn't view it as a negative thing. It wasn't, you know.
Yeah.
He was passionate about that opera and he wanted to play it right. So
there you go, and you got the passion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so you're gigging around just like South Africa.
So I was gigging, you know, it was like this. You know, you got to understand, I didn't know you could be a musician to make a living. At that point, I'm still kind of I call myself a blue collar bass player because I still think a little bit in that way, you know, mm-hmm. work kind of thing. And so, yeah, but one thing led to another. I started, you know, recording a show, which I don't know how I got through. I couldn't read. I don't know how I got through. The guy even threw a baton at me one time. And, you know, it was just this piecing things together and being terrified at times.
Yeah.
And just kind of doing it. And then, you know, then I finally had to make a decision because I was working just about every night. And then it's still going on the building site. So I decided, okay, it's got to be one or the other because it's dangerous. You know, a building site with your office.
Yeah.
So I decided, okay, let's go into the music, you know, do that. And I actually did the correspondence course from Berkeley. I'll never forget that. That got me a little bit more technically wise.
How did that work back then?
Well, there was a guy, this was the funny thing. There was a guy who was a teacher, was a guy named Hal Grossman. And I envisioned this kind of professor kind of guy, you know, with glasses or whatever. And he was actually Steve Grossman's brother.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I'm the only one in the history of the world that finished this freaking course. I mean, it was tedious. It was basically just writing stuff out.
Yeah.
He'd always put nice work, John, keep it up. But then I put a few intentional mistakes and he still said, nice, John, keep it up. There was no correction.
So were you mailing stuff back and forth?
Well, we'd mail it back and forth. There'd be assignment, like, 20 like yards.
Paper mail.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
It was crazy. But I got to say, it got me aware of things, you know, of more the technical side of things. So I knew nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I still don't know that much, but I knew less than I do now.
Well, there's kind of an advantage to learning by ear first, right? And then putting the pieces later.
I think so. I'm not sure, but I think so. I think it's, I prefer, I'm glad I learned that way, put it that way.
Yeah. Now I'm just remembering, that was something, that's how I grew up. And then, but you were helping me do it. Piecing the pieces together. So,
really?
Okay. Yeah.
Succeeded.
Yeah.
No, you were great, though. You were amazing. I mean, you were incredible.
But I like that kind of teaching where it's just no sugarcoating. I mean, I've gotten in trouble a few times telling people you sound like a square, like a wagon with a square wheel. You know, you're not swinging.
Right.
And then somebody's parent calls me, but it's okay. You know.
I mean, I said one time he came in this he was a good player, and I said, "Well, let's check your reading," you know. So he said, "No, man, I'm an improviser. I don't need to read." So I said, "All right, cool. We don't have to do that." So we just did that, and then about 3 weeks later, sure enough, he comes in. He's sweating. He's all nervous. He's, "Man, I've got to play this part. Can you help me?" I said, "Well, let me hear you play it." So he plays it. I said, "Wow, that sounded like you fell on the bass," you know.
Yeah.
And he said, "How can you say anything about that?" I said, "Well, you want to work on reading, you know." So then,
yeah.
It's just another. I mean, it's another thing in your back pocket. It's not, doesn't
exactly, mean. Exactly. I enjoy it. Yeah, I'd rather have a teacher invest in you. I had a classical teacher in high school. If he didn't like, or if he knew that you weren't going to get there, he would just say, "Oh, let's go have a milkshake." And I never wanted to get a milkshake. So I always practiced really hard.
Well, I mean, my goal really is to get everyone working, and that's that blue collar. Yeah. It's that mentality. I don't know if it's good or bad. I'm not even sure. But it's, if I'm not working, I get a little nervous. That's why when the pandemic hit, I was struggling. You know.
Well, yeah, that's where you get. That's so different from just practicing or even playing with people. That's not a performance, right?
Exactly. Totally.
It's kind of hard to learn anything if you're not on the bandstand in front of people.
Yeah, because you're on the spot. And the old guys, it doesn't happen anymore. We used to, you know, ream you out no matter where you were.
Mm-hmm.
So you get beat up. And people used to say to me, "How do you take it?" I'd been beaten up so many times. I said, "Take what?"
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it was just, that was that was the standard way in back in those days.
Yeah, and they're not mad at you. Like, I'm sure after the gig, they're like, they weren't mad at you. It's just now you know what to do.
Just they straightening out in a kind of terse way.
Yeah. So when did you finally stop mailing Berkeley and go to Berkeley? Was that like quickly?
Well, so that at that point, I was kind of, you know, we did the 6 nights a week. I was doing jingles, as I said. And Sunday night was the jazz night. And it was, you know, there was this little place called the Arts Center that was amazing. Because it was an arts center, the race thing broke down. Mm. And there were amazing nights in there. And then there was a guy named Mitch Pike who got us into free play. Because he lived he was really lived the life. Mm-hmm. And he was kind of like, I never studied with him, but I hung out with him a lot. And so he started this thing. We'd have these amazing free jams. I mean, just even put these abstract movies up and play to them and crazy stuff. We'd have penny whistle players and all kinds of things. And it was just a mishmash of, and then later on a place called The Space opened up, which was also in a kind of a factory place. And it was in the round, hard wooden seats. And we'd have, looking back, there was some, we didn't appreciate the players that were there. There were some amazing players that were just total natural players. Because we always looked out of the country as being
superior,
which is strange in a way.
Well, it's probably the environment, you know, socially and economically probably made it possible, like that free jazz, like people needed that, right? To express that way. Yeah.
I mean, we even one night, I remember the Hippo Symphony guys, you know, we played a regular set. It was more kind of fusion-y at that point. And they came in, the Hippo Cats, and took their bow ties off. And we must have had about 20, 30 people out there playing free.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy.
Now, I don't know how amazing it was, but it felt amazing. I don't know to listen, but people seemed to, you know. But, I mean, it was those kind of nights don't seem to happen like that so much anymore.
No. People need rules and structure.
Oh, man.
Was there anyone coming through town at all? Like, did you get to see anybody at that time?
The only guy that I can remember that I knew, I mean, there were local guys. I say this Merton Barrow was amazing. Mm-hmm. Not so much. He was open to anything. I'll give you an example of that. On the building site one time, we had this concrete mix-up. And here I'm in Africa where there's rhythms everywhere. But it was old, and the more you know, when you make concrete, you throw stone in, sand, water. You want to get a little water than the cement because it flies all over the place. But as this thing was grinding away, it would start backfiring. Mm-hmm. So we could so, man, this thing's got an amazing rhythm. You know, it's like incredible. I mean, it was random.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to bring it on the stage and play with it. I mean, it would be kind of this totally ridiculous drum machine because this was like 71 or something.
Yeah.
I don't think drum machines were out at that point.
He would have, if that was today, he would have won a Peabody, a Nobel Prize, Guggenheim, the MacArthur Grant.
He deserves it, but he definitely deserves some because he defied the rules in a kind of passive way, but he just totally defied them.
Mm.
And, you know, I did get a visit from the secret place one day, but he was amazing. And he's a result of so many people getting out of there and getting into music. I mean, I wouldn't have thought of being a musician if it wasn't for him.
Wow. Well, oh yeah, back to how did you leave South Africa?
No, the same thing. You know, it was those kind of hippie mentality days, had the hair and everything. But this young flute player was going to go to Berkeley. He was a lot younger than me. I was already 24. And he said, let's go to Berkeley. So I had enough money for a year. Which actually Berkeley at that time was cheap, but that's what I had. It was expensive to us.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, all right, I'll go for a year. You know, it was just loose. So I went over.
Was your family cool with that?
My dad was amazing because he was a carpenter by trade. So he was a worker guy. Mm-hmm. And you know, he just said, whatever makes you happy.
Yeah.
I don't care what you do. So, you know, a lot of his friends didn't approve of me being a musician. We almost looked down upon as kind of like derelicts. But he was totally... In fact, one night I was playing with this guy, this Robert Sotoli, this penny whistle player, who always had a big knife in his back pocket, you know. and there was a little scene broke out, you know, while we were playing. And he was going to this battle with this guy. And then I look out and there's my parents sitting there.
Oh, no.
And they were cool, you know, just one of them all. But anyway, yeah, so then this flute player got me to go to Berkeley. So I went over for the year, and what then I met a teacher named Alex Ulanovsky, did a gig with him. And I told him I got to go back. He said, well, maybe you can mark some papers. So I started doing like a, I suppose it was kind of like a work, not really work study, but I'd mark a few papers for him, transcribe, and then he'd get me the tuition.
Wow. You know, yeah, so yeah, those were the days you could do like a assistantship almost. And
yeah, I was so loose there then in those days. I mean, it was so wild. And then I met James Williams, and then we started playing a lot together.
Was he teaching at the school at that point?
I think that's when he came to teach, and then we were doing gigs all over the place, him and Billy Pierce, you know.
Did you finish Berkeley?
I did, because I needed a way to stay.
Oh, because for your visa? And
you know, I was in diploma, and I figured, man, this is the easiest place, because a lot of my friends were in a degree. Mm-hmm. I said, this is the easiest place in the world to get a degree. So I didn't even go to a lot of those classes because I was gigging, you know.
Yeah.
And somehow I got this degree, which these days you kind of need to get a gig.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of glad I got it. I was the only one in my family who got a degree. So my mother was like, oh, yeah. So it was kind of this big deal.
Oh, and when you got to Berkeley, was it kind of like a shock in terms of the amount of music like you were exposed to at that time?
Well, you see, we'd been told that if you walk down the practice room row, which was at that time was in the 150 had just been open. And it was, they said you'd be like a shaking mass from all the monsters you were hearing, but it really wasn't that way. And what paid off for me, I'd had a lot of experience because I've done this studio stuff. So I jumped right into Phil Wilson's blues band.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to Herb Pomeroy's recording band. So I lucked, so they, the better players were in there. So that meant I started gigging right away, even though it was not legal. But I started gigging just about every night with different setups. So I was lucky.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so cool that I don't know how long you've been when you started teaching, but like to meet like Phil Wilson and Herb Pomeroy in the 70s, right?
They were the cats, yeah, the two guys. Yeah,
and they had already been there for a while.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's very cool. Okay, so you're at Berkeley, you're gigging. What was it like playing with James Williams? Like, did you know about him really before you were there?
Well, he was also, you know, we were young. He was green. He was like all of us. You know, we were just kind of starting out.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know him. I met him there. And then, you know, we kind of connected. And then he'd bring a lot of guys up from Memphis. We used to play gigs all over the place. Sometimes with Alan Dawson. I played with Alan a lot later. Mm-hmm. A lot. Real life, but he played sometimes with us and in various settings. We even played with Sonny Stitt one time.
Wow.
A jazz workshop, which was an amazing club. And I was getting these sideman gigs. I mean, it's so hard because I was so naive. I didn't know anything, you know, back in those days. I didn't know anything. I didn't know much about anything at all, really. So it was just kind of like finding your way in a lot of ways.
It was like someone would call you and you wouldn't even think twice. You'd be like, yeah, I'll do that.
Well, this one time, this is one of those classic. I mean, this guy, Charlie, they used to call him Charlie the Whale. Charlie Lake was his name. And he was Buddy's road manager. He was a real old school roadie guy. Looked after you in all respects. And then he was Dizzy's road manager for many years. But he called me up to do this singer gig, you see. So I didn't know what I was. He said, yeah, the singer gig, my teacher, who was John Nares at Berkeley, had gotten sick, so they called me. And I had a little bit of attitude about singers. You know, it's like, you know, they never carry. I've changed now I'm cool, but they don't carry anything. They always moaning about the keys. So I kind of went with a little bit of an attitude. Ah, some singer gig, you know, whatever. And I get there, and the guy starts singing. And I go, wow, he can really sing. He's pretty good. It was Johnny Hartman. I'd never heard of him.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just, I'm glad I hadn't heard him because I would have been nervous as hell.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing. That was the kind of thing that was happening. It was just things just happening.
Yeah. And how was it for you, like just traveling through the States, even like you said, you're going to or was it like James Williams and things like that? What was your experience at the beginning?
Well, I've done a road gig before that, before Jim with the Sky, Lynn Bibiana.
Oh, yeah. I love Lynn.
Yeah, and it was kind of like a Maynard Ferguson thing.
Is he still around?
Yeah, he was teaching at Berkeley. I think he still is teaching at Berkeley, yeah.
Yeah, he's another one of those teachers that hard. Love it.
Yeah, oh, he's a tough guy. Yeah, no, yeah. He's always a tough guy. In fact, that's the first time I saw him. I shouldn't talk about that. No, I saw a dressing room getting broken up because there was this record contract that got turned down. I've never seen anyone break up a dressing room.
Nice.
I'd heard about it, but I've never really seen that. He's a great guy, though.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so it was, yeah. And just this thing just kind of snowballed from there. Oh, and then, of course, yeah, I got the call from Joe Henderson.
Mm-hmm.
I thought someone was playing a joke on me. I thought it was like a friend. I said, ah, yeah, sure. And then I realized, wait a minute, this is him. Wow. And he was like God, because I'd heard him on the Miroslav record. What's the name of the Infinite Search, I think it's called. And so I said to him, I said, I don't think I'm good enough. You know, so he said, well, send me a tape. So I sent him some tape we'd made in a place called Pooh's Pub with James and everyone. And I didn't hear anything back. And I was almost kind of relieved because I was scared, you know.
Yeah.
It was like God calling. And so luckily for me, I mean, this was sheer luck. I figured he didn't reply. So I figured he dig it, so he's not going to use me. I had a gig in this place called Sandy's Jazz Revival out in anyway. And so as I'm leaving the club, it was one of those gigs that wasn't happening at all. And I was like, maybe I should go back to construction or something.
Mm.
As I'm leaving, Sandy Berman, the club, said, I'll see you Tuesday. I said, what do you mean you see me? He said, well, you're playing with Joe.
Ugh.
If I hadn't done that gig, I wouldn't have showed up.
Yeah.
Because I thought, you know, so that was the beginning of some great stuff there.
And it's so cool to play with people like Joe. And I know you played with Freddie Hubbard too.
Right.
Again, like that Phil Wilson. It's like you'd been listening to them at least for a few years, and then to get to play with them while they're still playing, right? Like
right.
In their prime. That's such an experience.
So lucky. No, it's just really a long life.
Yeah. And at that time too, Boston was more of a hub for music than it is now, like more,
totally.
Comparative to New York, you know, where people would come through and play for a week or two.
Right. Right.
Those were the days.
That's definitely changed. I don't know. But, you know, sometimes these kind of times, I've noticed people in general, there's a wanting to be with people. You know, everywhere I've noticed, even just in regular settings, this is kind of a cool vibe.
Yeah.
It wasn't there before. Now, I don't know if it's going to kind of fade out again once everything gets going, but I hope it doesn't.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so, too. So what was, like, your first gig where you're traveling on the road, like either like to Europe or it's like a big road gig.
I did road gigs before that, but that Joe Henderson, because then he said, we did the week at Sandy's. And he said, he was kind of loose. He said, you want to play the Vanguard next week? I was like, oh, my heart kind of, I mean, that's like the Mecca. So yeah, you know, like, okay, yeah, great. So we go there, and then he said, you want to go to Europe in 2 weeks? And so just, that was my first trip to Europe. It was like 78. And
that's crazy. Who was in the band at that time?
It was Joanne Brakeen, mm-hmm. and this guy named Danny Spencer. And then it would change. You know, every time we play, I think Fred Hirsch did it a couple of times. Even did it once in Europe with Mel Waldron.
Wow.
And Micaiah, a guy from South Africa, right? Micaiah and Shoko, who lives, they both live in Europe at the time.
That's amazing.
Different people would do it, you know, all the time. I never knew who was going to be there, kind of thing.
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's crazy. They just chop and change.
And did you care? Because did you travel with your bass, or were you just using basses?
No, at that time I was you traveling with the bass.
Oh, really? Okay.
It was some serious problems, because in those days we used to buy, they would buy a seat.
Mm-hmm.
You never knew that with the airlines, there would always be this little bit of tension.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to act like you knew what you were doing.
Yeah.
Like you didn't know what you were doing, because then it was all over.
Yeah, just walk in with confidence.
Just kind of take over. Oh, I need a seatbelt extension. Okay. And then they protest you. Well, I can't, FAA regulations. I said, oh, don't worry, I got it. You know.
Yeah.
And you're just bluffing your way through the whole thing.
Exactly. I do want to talk about, there's a couple people I want to talk about that you played with. So playing with Mel Lewis in the Mel Lewis Orchestra, how did that come to happen?
Well, that was the same thing. You know, I think it was through Richie Perry. I'm mm-hmm. not sure how I got that. You know, you called for the audition was just went and played.
Yeah.
So you went down and played, and then I got it. And then actually a funny thing happened the very first night that I went in was when I showed up there, you're nervous because you've got to read like crazy. You know, I'm scared. I don't know what. And I saw this big van outside. This is my first night. And I said, wow, what's this? And then I see these wires going down the stairway, cables kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it was National Public Radio live.
Nice.
Oh, my God. Now I'm really freaking out. So I go down there. And Mel, they pull up a tune that I'd played before in other bands. Mm-hmm. It's not hard. But Mel said to me, it's just a blues. You know, so I thought, you know, because in the state, I thought he just wanted me to play blues. I didn't, you know, and I didn't follow the chart.
Oh, no.
It was a 16-bar blues. And the whole band had to stop because of me.
Oh, my gosh.
So that was, you know, those kind of things you can look back and laugh. But at the time, it was just a little bit rugged.
Yeah. But, did you stay on after that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, stayed on. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that because that was just the Mel Lewis Orchestra, and you guys were all wearing like uniforms, but it was more like loose and hip. Like instead of suits, it was more t-shirts, right?
No, well, that the funny thing because that's when it all started. He wanted to get more formal.
Yeah,
so they were t-shirts, but there's also jackets, and got more like it was like a uniform thing. You know? Mm-hmm. Because that's what attracted when I coming here to America. We stopped in London because the flute player had relatives there. We went to Ronnie's and we saw Thad Jones, Mel Lewis, and I loved it because they were all wearing dashikis.
Yeah.
But everyone had a different, it looked like a kind of a Monet painting or something. It was all mm-hmm. these colored dashikis. It was beautiful.
But so you missed that phase.
I missed that part.
Yeah. So how was it like playing with Mel?
You know, for me, it was a bit of a learning curve because I was used to playing kind of, I guess, way on top. I don't know. You know? Mm-hmm. And so the times he would get me on. I mean, when he said it was happening, the times I felt more kind of almost lethargic. But it was he had a special feel that was very unique.
Yeah.
Almost backside of things, you know, almost that thing. And yeah, he was amazing.
Yeah, I know he said, like, if you can't play with me, then you can't play. But yeah, I don't really care about ahead, behind the beat and stuff like that. But when you're playing with somebody, you're not really talking, right? You're just listening to him.
Feeling, yeah, just feeling where, you know, I mean, that's, I mean, you know, that thing that rides someone with, as soon as you know what it's going to be for that night. I mean.
Was he using the big cymbal at that point?
Well, yeah, that big kind of, what
it's
is
like 24 it? Or 26 inches.
Yeah, it's a big washy kind of cymbal. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing. How long did you stay on that band?
That lasted about 6 months. I remember what happened was I was moving to New York, and that was a little bit about 9 months, I think, or something. Yeah. Because, and I was feeling really weird. I mean, and I thought, oh, I'll get it checked out when I get to New York. I mean, I'd be carrying my stuff, and suddenly I'd have to stop, and all these kind of things would go up in my brain. You know, I thought, what the hell's going on? So I got to New York, and I went to this pretty strange doctor because my wife at the time, we didn't, yeah, that's weird, there's this big city with millions of people. I didn't know who to go to, you know, so
yeah.
We had a friend, and she sent me to this doctor. Anyway, so I had hepatitis, and the only cure was to rest. And,
oh, my gosh.
So everything I set up, and right at that time, Mark Johnson, Bill Evans, Mark Johnson would say, people were sobbing. Mm-hmm. And then Mel really liked him, so that was the end of me right there, you know. And then I lay in this room. I don't know if you know Joe Cohen.
Yeah.
So we were in one second. It was a big loft. It was a beautiful place. It was a sublet right on Fifth Avenue. Cheap, too. And he'd be practicing endlessly, you know, in the other room. And I could hear him, and I'd be just laying there because I couldn't even play. I was so beat up.
Wow.
And he'd trying to eat these stews I was concocting to get back.
You probably got hepatitis from being on the bus with all those people.
Yeah, it wasn't the syrup. It was the kind you get from mononucleosis when you don't take care of it.
Yeah.
It's viral, like it's viral hepatitis, they call it.
Yeah, were you on the bus? Like, were you busing it?
I was like, the energy thing was, I couldn't get my energy up, you know. And then I didn't feel like eating. That was another thing. So it was a strange period. But then that's when Gary Burton called. So I subbed with him a lot doing these European tours. I never had the gig, but I did a lot of tours in playing electric though.
Oh, cool. What was the format of that band?
Just quartet.
Nice.
And that went on right through, you know, many times. And then did a lot, because he was big in the Midwest too. So did a lot of those kind of things. And yeah, you know, it was.
Well, from Mel Lewis to hepatitis to Gary Burton. And but then you played, I remember you told me when we were taking lessons, like how you had played with Freddie Hubbard too. Cause it just seemed like you were the person that it's like, we need a bass player, go call John. Like you were like the person. You are the person.
See, that's what happened. I bought this shack in Maine that cost $15,000. I mean,
were you giving up on life and you're like, I'm moving?
No. This is before we moved to New York. We bought this shack, my wife and they actually turned us down for the mortgage. The mortgage was $15,000. They turned us down and she fought them, said they were discriminating against musicians. So they gave it to us. And I took a trip up there when I was trying to get better, I thought I'd go stay in a tent in the shed. And I took it, and the place was starting to fall down. It was actually leaning. I'm going to get up here and start banging nails, you know, because so that's when we decided to go for the summer and move to Maine, of all places. And then, you know, same kind of mentality that I came to America with was, so just ended up staying there. And I met actually some amazing, some really not a lot of great musicians up there.
Wow.
A guy named Lenny Bro, this guitar player. I'm trying to think, Chris Neville, Brad Terry. There were a couple of guys that could really play. So I started getting up there. I didn't know what I was going to do. And then that's when I came back to Boston. That's when I got the gig with Freddie in about around 86. And also playing with the Fringe. Played with the Fringe. Now we've been doing that for. It's an avant-garde band with George Gazzone and Bobby Gallardi, who just died last year, which was a drag. Right. It was his 50th year. We were going to celebrate the 50th with a whole slew of people in New York.
And 50 years?
They'd been playing together 50 years. I'd been in there about 30-something, 38, somewhere around there.
Wow.
So it's ongoing. It's just like every week you meet, you don't talk and go crazy kind of thing.
Yeah. But playing, we go back to Freddie Hubbard for a second. So you got called to play with Freddie. Was that just like a couple gigs or?
No, we did a gig at a place called Jonathan Swift's, and then did Blue Note a couple of times. One European trip, that's right. Then stuff around, you know, odd hits around the country. That's another gig. You had it and then you didn't have it. It was kind of like, you know, it was that kind of thing.
Kind of feel like, am I doing a good job? But sometimes it has nothing to do with that.
I don't know. You just got to accept it. You know, it's, sometimes you're in, sometimes you're out, and then, you know, go from there. But right through, you know, we're doing on and off up until the 90s when he hurt his lip. That was devastating.
Well, and someone like that are, do you guys have a set list that you're playing like each night, like, or like a collection of tunes?
No, Freddie, see what I did with what I do with what I've always done when I got the call, I had a couple of weeks, which was great. I transcribed everything he'd ever done. I even checked out his influences. I mean, I really, in fact, Larry Willis was playing one night. I had this little book with like in case, you know, so, and Larry didn't know the one too. I think it was Crisis or one of those two.
Oh, yeah.
I said, I threw the book and I said, it's in there, you know, because I knew it. I remember fumbling, trying to get through it and found the tune. Because that's always been, I figure even if you last one night on the gig, it's a great learning experience to really get inside the music.
Of course.
If someone to give you a chart or something, like that, you know.
Yeah, and there's no charts at that point.
No.
There's nothing published. He didn't have anything written down.
No, he was great though. I mean, what I loved about that, a lot of the old school guys, you knew what they felt. There was none of this kind of corporate thing that's crept into a lot of music settings now. It's just, if they lay you out, you know, if they felt something, and it was honest, very honest. That's the word.
would at that time, would he play less songs, like, and just play longer?
It varied. Sometimes, you know, sometimes the sets were long. Sometimes 2 hours. And I mean, it varied. He just worked off a whim. He didn't know who did, because the bands were always changing. He just worked off a whim. Joe Henderson tended to play the same tunes. That way everyone knew what tunes they were going to play. But I think Freddie Hubbard, always, there was always different calling different tunes. And kind of really expecting you to know it in a way.
Yeah, and when you don't know the songs and you don't know what you're playing or for how long, you don't have some sense of like, okay, I'd only have to focus from this hour to this hour. You're like, you're very focused, right?
Oh, totally. Because he heard everything, so he turned around right on the spot. You knew he was tough, you know. So I don't want to mess with Freddie Hubbard, and it's, you know, so it's just you were always ready for anything, kind of thing.
Yeah, woo, that's amazing. Have you ever experienced any, other than the hepatitis, any injury while, like, on the road or playing with people?
I've been lucky because I still do a lot of sports and things even now. And I did wreck my shoulders. One time I did, you know, I do some taekwondo. And I went in and the guy said, what do you want to do to the young guy? And I said, well, let's box today, like a fool. And it wasn't the boxing, it was the pounding, the heavy bag, and I was trying to keep up with him like an idiot. And, you know, I really got problem shoulders from the hitting the rocks when I used to surf. Mm. So it's like, so now this is a constant. Tonight I'll be working them out. Mm-hmm. Maybe today I did some weights just to cool them out. If I don't do that, then it's all over. But they're pretty much back, I'd say 95%.
Oh, good. Yeah, I mean, that's such an important part of, even if you're not like an athletic person, you do have to stretch, you do have to like lift some sort of resistance, right?
I think so, you know, and I think, although you see these, you know, frail little people playing the hell out of the bass, I'm not sure if it's a strength thing, but just carrying it maybe.
Yeah.
You know, that can be.
Yeah, I think even if you have some padding around your stomach. I think most bass players, the good ones, have like a strong core.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Core is the meaning of everything. I discovered that. You can do that with Pilates and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I won't take up too much more of your time, John, but what year did you start at Berklee? And did they ask you to teach or did you want to teach at that point?
Yeah, I didn't. I taught a little bit at New England, mainly because a kid wanted to study with me. I said, well, this was about early 90s. He came to one of the gigs. I want to take a lesson with you. And I said, all right, but only way I'm going to do it, you come to my house. It was apartment, actually. Come to my apartment, then you get them, you know, to pay me. So I did that. And then they get, sometimes I get one student, mm-hmm. sometimes I get five students, then sometimes I get three or four. Because Hank Kosnetsky was the chair at the time. He said, why don't you take a few more? So I didn't take it seriously. I got to admit, it was just like, I got to do this, you know. But then I had the kids came along, the boys, and they were about 3 and 5. And it was kind of a struggle each month, because when you have kids, you've got to come up with a bit of a nut every month. Mm-hmm. And you're not just thinking about yourself. And so.
No.
Which has always been the past, you know.
Yeah.
And I was kind of, I was already, about 45, 46. No, I was older. I was close to 50. But anyway, so then they. Berklee had called over the years, but I always had turned it down. And then Billy Pierce was the one that said, listen, and John Ramsey, they said, if you're going to do it, you should do it now because it's getting a much more, you've got to jump through more hoops to get more presentation kind of stuff and all that. And that's when I jumped in there too. And it was the best thing I ever did because that's what, it got me into. I started very minimally, like 5 hours or something. And then Richie was the chair at the time, Rich Alman. Steve Bailey said, no, but Rich Alman was the chair, and he said, you want a few more hours? And I said, all right, you know, and it gradually inched up over the years kind of thing.
So that was like the late 80s you started?
No, this was about 18, this was about 99, actually. 98.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, because we played a gig the night before for the Zildjian family, and they were honoring Louis Belson, Alvin Jones. It was Roy Haynes, Yeah, but Smitty, all the different drummers were representing them, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's well. We're glad you're at Berklee. What's like one of the things? What was like the hardest thing starting up, like having like a teaching studio for you?
I had no idea how to approach it, really. You know, I'd never thought of myself as a good teacher. I'd judge how long people would stay with me, which was usually one time, and then they wouldn't come back. On privately. So I think, oh, I'm just not a good teacher. And so it was a learning thing. It's, you know, of how to approach it, how to, you know, be more individual. I didn't want to have a system as such. Mm. I still have a method or whatever. And I still don't do that. I try to find person's passion. Mm. Whatever, and then link stuff into that via that route, because I think it's, yeah, that's what I still try to do. But that was a learning thing. I had to learn how to do that. I didn't know how to, you know, and I've gotten a lot better over the years. I'll say so myself.
Well, yeah, and it's one of those things that you learn better, like how to teach, and did some things become, once you were teaching more and more, become more apparent in your own playing of like stuff you wanted to do or wanted to fix. Totally.
Yeah, totally. And a lot of the exercises, I'm sure you've done the same thing, where that I created for myself, I use when I'm teaching. Mm-hmm. Out of benefits, things that I was trying to fix on my own stuff, I've transferred it over to a teaching thing. And now with Finale, it's so easy to just bang out these exercises instead of handwriting them. You know.
Well, good for you. I this is like the extent of my computer use, so I still handwriting. That was one thing, Berklee. I didn't do well with that. All that computer stuff.
Yeah, I've gotten, since this last year, I've come light years. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the time here, but I've come light years. I'm doing Logic now. I mean, I say I'm doing it. You know, I'm doing these things. But I get the guys, because one thing also saved me in this pandemic, doing sessions.
Mm-hmm. Oh, just like home studio things?
Just, I finally got a house. It's got a basement. And so people want to play. And started with one guy saying, let's play, put masks on 12 feet apart, and then snowball to a few more people. And now sometimes, you know, one, two sessions a day.
Nice.
That's kind of cool. Are you doing anything yourself at all?
Things are coming back slowly. I've done a couple studio things since the pandemic, and I've done some, nothing with audiences, but playing with masks on. But yeah, it's coming back. I have a... I'm going to practice after this because I have a duo concert with John Clayton on Friday that's going to be live streamed. So I got to.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, the last time I was in Boston at that cafe, the $9.99 or whatever it is.
Oh, yeah.
It sounded amazing. You guys sounded really amazing.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I always love coming back there just for a day or two. Well, John, thank you so much. Is there anything coming up for you? I mean, I know you teach at Berklee, Longy or Longy?
I teach a little bit of Longy. It's kind of minimal, you know. It's mm-hmm. I used to do ensemble there, but I haven't done that in a while. And then I do NEC too.
Yeah,
ensemble, some private, but it's minimal. It's not like it sounds like a lot, but it's bits and pieces, you know.
Yeah,
and I like the diversity because they're all very different from each other.
Yeah, so it's super different student bodies, right?
Totally different. Totally different.
Yeah. Is there anything coming up for you, or we're riding out the quarantine?
I mean, I got little gigs. I mean, I lost a kind of a cool gig in November because of it was with Lovano and Gozone and Braganzi, I think, and Bill Stewart and Leo Genovese was going to be kind of at Birdland, but that went out the window like everything else. Mm-hmm. But right now, there's a couple of recording things. There's a couple of odd gigs, you know. But I'm just taking everything.
Yeah,
that's all you can do. Everything.
Exactly. I know. I got so excited that things, they're under the radar, so I can't say what things are. But a Thursday night regular duo, it's going to be great just to play.
When you do the thing with John Clayton, where is that going to be?
I'll send it to you. It's going to be, it's virtual, so.
Oh, virtual.
Yeah, yeah, I'll send you the link.
Yeah, I'd love to hear that. That'd be great.
Yeah. So, yeah, I always get, I don't get nervous so much playing with him, but I studied with him too. So, like, if I was to play with you, I would be thinking, trying not to think about that while I was playing.
No, you were always great. You're kidding me? The lessons used to kick my ass. I was prepared for your lessons.
Hey, John, thank you so much. It was really great to catch up with you. And
yes, totally.
Because as student teacher stuff, you don't talk about these things unless I never asked. So that was my fault.
No, but it's really, I mean, you've done amazing. It's incredible.
Well, thank you, John. Take care. You probably have a session tonight or tomorrow to do. And I can't wait to see you play live again. I love your playing.
Oh, thanks. Back at you, too. I mean, it was always great to hear you and see you.
Well, awesome. Cool. Thanks, John.
Yeah, send me that link. I'd love to hear it, you know.
Oh no. Okay.
All right. Okay.
Thanks so much. Take care. Bye.
Give my best to everyone.
I will. Bye.